Okay, so, boy, I guess I'm a total ditz case these days. I didn't remember to, couldn't plug in my laptop and was wondering why it wasn't working. So I have to confess to another one, which after I started thinking about it, I realized where the confusion was. Let me zoom this. At the start of the term, the date that I was going to have our first recitations is Martin Luther King Day, and so that was going to put us on a Wednesday, Friday, Monday cycle. And I think I made the decision to start us the following Monday, right? Somehow in my mind, over the last month, that morphed into we started on the day after the Wednesday after Martin Luther King Day. So I've been thinking our cycle has been Wednesday through Monday, but it didn't matter because I've been meeting with TAs talking about the recitation on Thursday, so it was sort of irrelevant. So I'm sorry for that confusion. So anyway, no recitations today. So I apologize for having confused people. I know of at least one person who was going to go to today because of my offhand comment, and so feel free to come by and ask questions or ask questions of the TA. So sorry about that. But we won't have recitations this week, and we should have them when you return. In terms of exam grading, I had to actually finish giving the exam and then take off the Fermi lab and have been gone pretty much since then. So I'm going to meet with the TAs this afternoon and we're going to look at the exam. So hopefully, I mean, my fingers are crossed that we actually can get it all done by Wednesday. So that's what I'm still hoping to do. It's not that they're all that hard to grade on the scale of things, so it just depends a little bit on what the schedule is for the TAs. So any questions about any of that? Okay, so we've been doing a lot of background stuff, and I have to apologize a little bit about it, but only a little bit, because I actually think a lot of this background stuff is pretty cool in and of itself. But we're about to start to get into some pretty strange stuff in full-blown quantum mechanics. Probably today is still a bit more background, but we are going to start getting into some pretty bizarre stuff now. I just wanted to remind you where we are. We've established that light is a wave, and then we saw that there are experimental reasons to believe that light is also a particle, that basically things that cannot be understood unless you can interpret light as a particle, so that in fact light was discovered in the early part of the 1900s to have both properties of waves and particles, very clearly properties of the waves and very clearly properties of the particles. So you're sort of stuck with this duality. And then in the mid-1920s, de Broglie came up with the hypothesis that if light has this strange duality, perhaps matter particles do as well. And this also turns out to be the case. And this sort of wave-like duality, wave-particle duality of matter particles helped motivate a scheme that came out in around 1912 by Niels Bohr, which was the first modern picture of the atom, I guess, is how I think of it. And in this picture, he has all the positive charge in the nucleus centered at the center, centered in the atom, and the electrons orbit in circular orbitals, and they only can exist for certain discrete circles. And this is where the wave-like nature comes in, because basically you choose those circles where you could form standing waves, sort of circular standing waves for the wavelength of the electron. And it's the Coulomb force that holds the electron in by the nucleus. And then light is absorbed or emitted in this particular atom by the absorption of photons kicking an electron from a lower energy orbital up to a higher energy orbital, or emitted by the electron dropping from a higher energy orbital down to a lower energy orbital. And there's a an exact correspondence between the energy of the incoming or outgoing photon and the difference in energy between those two orbitals. So the minute you discretize these orbitals, you have also discretized the atomic spectrum, which you've seen is happens to be the case. All right. So this then is a pretty reasonable, from the modern point of view, this is actually a pretty reasonable model of the atom to carry in your head. It has a lot of the features of the truly modern picture of the atom, which we're about to go through. So are you okay with this? Any questions? All right, so that's sort of the background of where I want to start from today. The thing I want to point out about this is a semi-classical model. It makes use of quantizing these orbits, which Bohr put in a very ad hoc way, and then in the mid-1920s, when there was the realization that the electron might be a wave, it basically was put in a sort of a hand-waving way about standing waves. So you sort of take this classical model and you sort of try to throw in the wave-like characteristics. But that's not really a grounds-up picture of solving for the atom where the electron is thought of as a wave. The mathematics in this does not think of the electron as a wave. The mathematics is treating it as a particle that's moving in a circle under the influence of a central force, which is the electromagnetic force. And that's a purely classical picture. What is amazing in this is that even that classical picture gets pretty much the hydrogen spectrum correct. Not exact, but almost. And it doesn't do so well for many other atoms. But single electron atoms, it actually does pretty well. Yes?
What do you mean the mathematics?
If you want to solve for the radii and the energies of these orbitals, then you start from the assumption that the electron is moving in a circle. So you use, I think we did it in a recitation, the force toward the center is mv squared over r, and you take into account that the kinetic energy of the electron is 1/2 mv squared, and you then put in an assumption about which of these you want to allow, and you put all that math together. But in doing so, you're basically assuming it's a point-like particle moving in a circle. So that's the assumption is very classical. If you know that the electron is a wave, then you know this just can't really quite be right, because you have to, from the grounds up, solve for it in terms of being a wave. And so in the 20s, people did that, but they had to figure out how to do it, because it's different from the classical physics that you're used to. So here are the two guys who succeeded in doing it first, Werner Heisenberg and Erwin Schrödinger. Both of them have won the Nobel Prize for this work. Heisenberg's solution was a bit more mathematical. Schrödinger's solution was a bit more similar in terms of a wave equation, in the way that physicists were a bit more used to thinking. It's a little bit more easy to visualize. At any rate, you should see their pictures. We're going to talk a lot about the work that they've done. There's a very famous equation which is the basis of quantum mechanics, which is called Schrödinger's equation, which, you know, clearly we're not going to be doing a lot with the math and everything, but I'll just, first of all, just wanted to show, this is one form of it, I just wanted to show it to you, and there is one piece I wanted to point out. We're going to talk about the structure of the atom, and then we're going to move to other things where quantum mechanics is important, and what quantum mechanics can and cannot do, and what it can and cannot tell you, and what that means for our view of the universe. In this equation, there's a quantity which Schrödinger calls psi, which you see in three different places here. And this is something he calls the wave function, which is basically a description of whatever the object is you're trying to describe, which is the wave. In this case, I've written it as a function of position. You can also have a time-variant form. This is sort of an acceleration. Well, no, sorry. This is a spatial change term. This V represents something which we call a potential, which means if I have a particle that's in any sort of force or whatever, I can put that information here. And it could be any sort of physical situation. And this happens to represent the energy. The only point I'm really trying to make with this is this equation is completely general. And what you do if you want to solve something with quantum mechanics is you look at the physical situation that you've got and you basically put the description of that physical situation in for what this V happens to be, basically the description of the force that that particle is experiencing. And then you have to solve for this thing, okay? And the closest you ever want to get to that is to go to the PS library and look at some of the physics major juniors screwing their face up as they're crying over their problem sets. The mathematics can be pretty miserable. Now I'm ditzing on what I wanted to say right here. Okay, so let's look at a particular example. We'll sort of look at other examples, but what I would like to do is to show an example of a system and then tell you about the solutions that come out of this equation when you crank the mathematics on it. So the system that I would like to look at is by far and away the most important substance that we know of in our universe, which is the hydrogen atom. And the hydrogen atom consists of a proton, which has a charge of +1. Sitting at the center, and then there is an electron which is out from the proton, and I've drawn it in a strange sort of way. Bohr's model had another problem, which was it was sort of a two-dimensional thing. It was like a planetary system. But if I have a positive charge sitting here, and that's all I've got, it's not a two-dimensional problem. It's a three-dimensional problem. So if I now plop an electron there, it could move. It doesn't have to be constrained to just move in a circle. So that's a problem. So one of the things we want to do, if we say, okay, we're going to, first of all, use Schrodinger's equation because that works for particles that have wave-like characteristics. Secondly, I'm not going to do it in the plane. I'm going to do it in a full three dimensions. So it's actually a three-dimensional spherical problem. So that's why I drew the electron sort of in this way. So it's out some radius from the center, but it can move in full three dimensions. So if we put the electron in a spherically symmetric, this is lingo, potential. What I really mean by that is force. So in the electromagnetic force, I have a positive charge here, and at a certain distance away on the surface of a shell, the same distance away, you have the same force. It's always toward the center, but it's sort of the same magnitude just by this nature of this force. And so you take this physical situation and you pop it into Schrodinger's equation. And you solve it. And this actually is difficult to solve. I mean, it is something that is soluble exactly, and not all things that you write down can actually be solved. Sometimes there's not an exact solution to it. And there are ways to use computer programs to get an approximation of the solution, but this one is one which can be solved exactly when you put it in there. It's a real pain, and there's pretty much the better part of an entire course for junior physics majors is set up around figuring out how to solve this and what it means. So what I'm going to tell you is what comes out of it. So one of the things that comes out of it is that only particular allowed spatial and energy states. Oh boy. Only particular spatial and energy states are allowed. So we don't put quantization in this discreteness of the atomic orbitals. We don't put in an ad hoc way. I don't say, well, I'm only going to allow this one or this one. This time, all I do is put the geometry of this problem in the equation, and what pops out of the solution is only particular things work. And so that's one thing that comes out of this. So the quantization of these orbitals comes out of it. And we call these things quantum states. And so how do we think about a quantum state? What do I have here? Okay. So the way that I think about quantum state, I use an analogy actually, which is maybe a little bit silly, but imagine that we are at the base of a ski mountain and we have these different ski chalets that are sort of going up the hill. And if you show up at this ski mountain, you could spend the night here, you could spend the night here, you could spend the night there, you could spend the night there. If you're going to spend the night here, you don't need much energy. You know, if you park down here, all you got to do is walk in, fall in the bed. If you want to spend the night here, you now got to walk up the hill. And if you want to spend the night there, you've got to walk way up the hill, okay? But basically, when you say there's a quantum state, it means there's sort of this location where you could be found. So when we solve for the hydrogen atom solution, there are very particular solutions where the electron could be found. And what one of the things that comes out of quantum mechanics is if I have a hydrogen atom sitting here, I actually don't know where the electron is in the hydrogen atom. What I get is a map of the places where it could be and a probability of where it might be. Okay, so, you know, it's a certain percent probability the electron will be sleeping in the lower house, and you know, a 10% probability it's in the upper house. That's the kind of information that quantum mechanics gives you. And the houses are sort of strange shapes. So if we look at the lowest energy state for the hydrogen atom, if this is my proton, and I'm going to put pink dots that will correspond where the density corresponds to the probability of finding the electron if I could somehow know where it is instantaneously for a moment, what you would find is that it's spherically symmetric and the probability of finding the electron drops off dramatically as you go away from the center, but it's spherically symmetric and peaks right at the center. Then there's another energy level or another state where the proton is in the center, for example, and now in this one I have a high probability of finding the electron near the center and then almost no probability of finding it for a little while, and then there's a pretty high probability of finding it in a shell, a spherically symmetric, in spite of how I drew it, shell that surrounds, and then it sort of falls off a bit. So it's a sort of a weird geometry, okay? So in the quantum mechanics language, this is called the N=1 state. This is called the N=2 state. Any questions on sort of what I'm trying to do? Yeah. That's right. That's the next the lowest energy state. Yeah.
Is this for an atom in general or just for a hydrogen?
This is actually for any atom that has a single electron in it. So hydrogen, yes. Helium, if you remove one of the electrons, because helium has two. Lithium, if you remove two of the electrons. And we're going to get quickly into multi-electron atoms in just a second when I paint the picture.
So the further out the electron, well, I guess there's only one, but the further out the electron is, the lower the energy state is.
Yep. Yeah, the closer it is, the more tightly it's held. Okay, so this is it conceptually. Now I'm going to show you what actually comes out of the equation. What you see here are basically pictures of the different available chalets in the hydrogen atom. All right? The N=1 isn't even listed. That would be basically a sphere centered right on the hydrogen atom. This is the N=2, which is the one I pictured for you second. So this is the central core, and here's a shell on the outside. Then there's an N=3, which has a central core, a shell, and then another shell outside. Yeah.
Where's the electron for the N=2?
It is somewhere. Well, it could actually be anywhere in the universe. Okay? But what you see, if you consider only the N=2 level for a particular hydrogen atom, is the probability of finding the electron there will scale with the brightness of this picture. So it is most likely in this central piece, in fact, peaking right where the proton is. And there's some pretty decent probability of finding it in that shell. And even though it's not a zero probability of finding it 100 miles from here, there's a mathematical possibility. In other words, this gets dimmer and dimmer as you go out. Yes?
Does a shell only exist if there's an electron currently on it? I mean, are there still shells with just one electron?
The states, we believe, exist independent of whether a particle is actually living in it or not. Okay? They're available. So if I take the physical situation, I solve for it, there are particular discrete places where the electron in principle could go. And then it depends on what its energy is as to where it happens to be.
Okay, so the shells aren't just used to refer to the potential areas of the electron to be, they actually are their own thing. I mean, their own field, or there's something there besides the electron. Or are they just used to kind of mark?
No, there's nothing there. What I'm doing is painting a picture of there's nothing physical there like a house on the ski hill, but I'm using these to demarcate the possible places where the electron could hang out. Yeah. So I guess the ski chalet analogy breaks down there. It would be better to say, you know, there are spots on the hill where you're allowed to have your campfire, and the rest of the place you're not. So
theoretically, you could have an atom of just infinite. I mean, the shells really are just, the amount of shells are just continuing.
Well, all atoms have a whole slew of energy levels and shells. And so then the question is, which ones are actually populated? And that is determined by the nature of the atom and how many electrons are there. At some point when it starts getting far away, and especially for the multi-electron atoms we're about to picture, there'll be other electrons in here. So if there are other electrons on the inside, for example, and I have an electron out here, this electron would see the positive charge from the nucleus, but it'd also see a bunch of negative charge in here that would sort of screen it. So the positive charge attracting this toward the nucleus would be a lot less. So it'd be real easy to pull this electron off. And so we're about, okay, so let me just go on and you'll see how that works, because that's actually what makes chemistry work, is the different characteristics of how the atoms are holding on to their electrons. So here are a lot of strange pictures of the different types of houses that the electrons can occupy in a single hydrogen atom in principle. And then so when you solve the equations, what you get are all of these possibilities. And some of these actually have the same energy, but they're actually separated in space. Some of them are they're different energies, and you're going up in energy as you go out. These, with the lobes, for example, there's actually one like this, one like that, and one like this. So they're... So you have to imagine that this goes three-dimensional. So this is really what pops out. So this would be actually the modern atom. And if we now just consider the hydrogen atom and we calculate these energies and we look at the differences between these, the energy in these different orbitals, and compare it to the atomic spectra we see for hydrogen, you do get exactly what you see in the laboratory, which is really an amazing statement. So this wave nature of matter, all of a sudden quantum mechanics, this was the first real major problem that needed to be solved in quantum mechanics. If you couldn't do this, then you're not going to do anything with quantum mechanics. If you're going to assume electrons are waves, you need to develop the wave mechanics to solve the problem, and the simplest thing to do is to solve for the hydrogen atom. And the best way to know if you've got that right is to solve for the energies and then ask, does it absorb and emit light at exactly the right frequencies? And it does. So this is actually a huge, huge step in science. This is a big deal.
Are those potential what an atom can potentially look like? I mean, these like those light bulbs, are those like clusters of electrons on different...
They're not clusters. These are places where an electron could be. But in a sense, if you could visualize that, then I guess in a sense this would be sort of what an atom would look like to you.
For example, like the bottom right one, just the two big light balls. Are those the electron can't, I'm just kind of confused. Are those balls potentially like traveling around on a shield, like a ring? Or they're just kind of staying where they are?
Yeah, they
because I always envision like an electron like moving along the ring.
Yeah.
Is it just kind of stationary at one point on the ring?
I mean, I'm trying to remember whether this is actually a toroidal piece or whether it's sort of a lobe, because these are not all spherically symmetric, so that you do get things that break that symmetry. Here, for example, these are rings. These are rings. These may be lobes right here. This may be a ring. That's a lobe or something like that. I forget. We'd have to go look at the...
So a shield isn't necessarily a ring.
Right. These aren't necessarily spherically symmetric. But what is true, that if you were to take two atoms and sort of try to get them to interact, if you were overlapping these shapes, that would be sort of... you would be really doing some serious interacting there. And if you're far away with those shapes, you're not going to be interacting so much. Yeah?
What dictates the energy level?
When you solve the mathematics, out will pop certain energies that are associated with certain shapes. So that's really what dictates it. If you want to sort of motivate that and sort of understand it, The factors that come into play are how much charge is in the center. If you have a lot of charge, the differences in energy are much greater, and an electron near the center is bound much more tightly. The distance from the center, the further away, the less it's held, so the energy is less. It's not bound as tightly. And as we're about to see, if we have other electrons in the atom, if you're further away, they sort of screen you, so you're not held as much. So there are a lot of little factors that come into play. You okay for the moment? All right. Okay, so a number of these, my little ski chalet thing, it turns out that as you see, there are lots of possibilities, and it turns out that in these weird shapes, some of them actually have the same energy. So it's more like you have the houses at the different energies, but you can have multiple houses at certain energies, okay? And then the question is, if I stop with a busload of skiers, how do they distribute themselves among the houses? So that's really the question. We basically have solved for the hydrogen atom. Okay, that actually works. Now the question is, can we use this picture and try to understand more complex atoms? And so what makes the difference between a hydrogen atom and a more complex atom? A more complex atom, or a different element, has more charge at the center, so it can hold things more tightly in principle. But the main thing is, for every positive charge I have at the center, I have a negative charge, an electron that goes in the outer orbitals. So more complex atoms means I have to figure out how the electrons distribute themselves among these possible orbitals. So people tried to do that. Let me decide for a moment how I want to proceed. Okay, well that's fair enough. So just a reminder of the basic structure of the atom. We believe that we have Z protons in some nucleus that has a charge of plus Z. So if it has plus Z in the center, then we say that we have A minus Z neutrons. So let's say the protons are the black ones, the neutrons are the circles. And the size of this nucleus, this is about 10 to the minus 15 meters, so it's very, very small. And then at about something like 10 to the minus 10 to the minus 10-ish, 10 to the minus 8-ish, we have these clouds, these electron probability distributions that I showed you. So I'll draw them as circles, but you think of those weird shapes that you just saw. So the truth is, and the electron, as far as we know, is point-like. This central piece is very small, 10 to the minus 15 meters in radius. So the truth is, the electron is almost all empty space. The atom. As weird as that may seem. So mostly matter is really just a force field, if you want to think about it. We're mostly empty space. The most of the mass is concentrated at this tiny little core in the center. But the picture that the thing I want to talk about now. Let me make one other point. So hydrogen has Z equal 1. Helium has Z equal 2. Lithium has Z equal 3. and on. And there, we only know of elements that go up to about Z of, I don't know, something like 120 something. So there are only that many distinct types of different types of atoms that we know about that are out there. And the key to understanding how these different atoms interact with other things around them has to do with how the electrons are associated, how they fill the various levels. But to understand that, we need to see one other thing, which actually has to do with something called, I call particle promiscuity. Electrons are just little negative charges. And if you take a negative charge and you send it through a magnetic field that's actually growing in strength, so changing in the region that the electron is going through. If the electron is just a negative charge, I'm not saying this well. If we have an atom, okay, and we have a picture of the atom as an electron orbiting in a circle, then you can think of this as a loop of electric current. And I guess we haven't talked about it, but if I have a loop of electric current and I send it through a non-homogeneous magnetic field, I would expect a beam of these atoms to basically go all the way through and just stay in one place. And if I have a detector on the other side, they would all hit at the same spot. What was found when people tried to do this experiment was they found that, in fact, a beam of atoms would split into two as we sent it through. And the way to interpret this is a little bit strange, but the thing that fits this data is to realize that the electron has an additional characteristic that was unknown up to this point, and we call that characteristic spin. And the way to think about it is that you could imagine the electron as like a ball of spinning electric charge, and it turns out that if I take electric charge and I move it in a circle, it will create a magnetic field in the space around it that looks exactly like you would get if you had a little bar magnet. Okay? And so what happens is that the electron in the atom is like a little tiny bar magnet that can be oriented with the magnetic field or against the magnetic field. And depending on how it's oriented, basically it will cause the atom to go one way or the other, okay, or it will cause a splitting in the energy. So this was a pretty major discovery, and people were, I love this guy, I mean, Stern and Gerlach are the ones who actually discovered this. I love a quote that Stern had from earlier, this was many years later, in 1913. He said, "If this nonsense from Bohr proves to be right, I'll quit physics." Fortunately, he didn't quit physics, and of course what Bohr did more or less was right, insofar as you could do at the time. At any rate, this is a weird, nobody ordered this, I mean, it just was something we discovered, and it turns out to be a generic property of particles, okay? If you have a particle, it might have a spin of zero, which means it doesn't act like a little bar magnet, or it could have a spin of a half, which means it could act like a bar magnet up or down, or it could have a spin of three halves, which could mean it's like a stronger bar magnet. So it's a little bit strange, but it turns out to be a really important quantity. It could also have a spin of one, so there are lots of possibilities for the spin. So spin's a bit of a strange thing. And you can think of it as having like a bar magnet, and a bar magnet will have a magnetic field that looks like this, where we have the North Pole and the South Pole here. You can actually get the same thing if you have a sphere of charge spinning around. It will also give you a magnetic field that looks like this, which is basically where the word spin comes from. That's why we have it. But it's a little bit worse than just having a little bar magnet, because in the particle world, basically you could imagine this little ball can be spinning with a certain speed. It could be spinning with zero, or it could be spinning with a certain speed, or it could be spinning with multiples of that particular speed. Why? I don't know. It's just quantization. Yes?
Can they get an atom to have electrons that have a predictable spin? How can they do that if it's just a probability of where the electron is just a probability?
You can select atoms that have electrons in the certain orbitals, so certain energies.
Right.
And you can do that in part because if the electron's in certain energies, it will have certain spin or charges or whatever. There are ways to make selections, but that's not to say if I have a given atom, I can tell you where the electron is in that one. It's more like you'd make a population and select the ones that are where you want them. Okay, so I know spin seems really weird, and I'm not going to try to gloss over that. I sort of have to tell you how it is, and I can't really tell you why it is. But particles have intrinsic spin, and this spin turns out to be quantized. The picture that I have for spin is you can think of the particle as basically being a little spinning charge that can create a like a little bar magnet, but that spinning can only be zero, or a certain speed, or like twice that speed, or three times that speed. And you say, why? And I say, well, why do we? Can we only have the electron in a certain orbital, or another orbital, or a different orbital in the hydrogen atom? This is just sort of the way nature seems to work. So spin is quantized, and so we, in particular units, if I somehow say, okay, there's a fundamental unit of spin, okay, which I'll call 1/2 unit, and then multiples of 1/2 I can have. So the spin, we say, can be 0, it can be 1/2, it can be 1, it can be 3/2. So the fundamental unit is basically this 1/2. It can be 2, it can be 5/2. And if we have particles that have integer spin, so if they have a spin of 0, 1, 2, etc., these types of particles are known as bosons. Don't ask me why. If you have half integer spin, these are known as fermions. And the reason that I'm dragging you through this particular mud is that bosons and fermions actually interact with the rest of the world a little bit differently. These turn out to be different in what they can do to the rest of the world, or how they interact with things. So, for example, if you have bosons, then You can think of bosons as very promiscuous. I can't spell it at all. Promiscuous. What do I mean by that? If you have bosons, they're happily sharing the same quantum state. So if I had a pile of electrons, if they were bosons, and I put them in an atom, they would very happily all sink down to the lowest energy quantum state. They would all sleep in the house at the bottom of the hill very happily. Okay? So bosons would do that. If you have particles that are fermions, you can have only one particle per quantum state. And it turns out that electrons have a spin of 1/2. So they're fermions. And so the reason this is important is that if I have all of these available shells for the electrons to go, and I come in this big pile of electrons to go in this multi-electron atom, how do they line up in the shells? And so when you get to the ski resort, you get something like this. You have all the possible places for them to go. So now picture each person in the house as being a different electron. And here is a sodium atom, for example, where you have 11 electrons. So how would they naturally populate the sodium atom? Basically, they will tend to populate the lowest energy shells as possible, and you can put 2 per shell because they're in, you say, but that's the same quantum state. Well, one has spin up and one has spin down, so the spin is, turns out to also dictate the quantum state. So we actually think of this as 2 states, that 2 states, this 2 states, 2 states, 2 states. But so what happens in sodium is in this lowest energy level, which in the language of the business we call it the 1s level, you'll get the 2 electrons, then in the next you'll get 2, and then the next energy level we actually have 3 different of those states that all have the same energy, and they'll all populate that, and then you have 1 electron left over which is at a higher energy. Okay, for chlorine you do sort of the same thing, but now you have, as they populate, you have more electrons and you end up with 1 extra over here. It turns out that if you were to take a pile of sodium and a pile of chlorine and dump them together, you'll get a very violent chemical reaction where what happens is that this electron is removed from the sodium atom and goes into this orbital of the chlorine and releases energy in the process, and you form table salt. So I guess the picture I'm trying to tell you, to paint for you, is that this idea of exactly the available shells for the electrons to fill, along with the scheme of how they fill it, determines the energies of these electrons and how easy it is for them to be removed. And that's really what chemistry is. That, I mean, if you want to know what kinds of atoms are reactive, or how many carbons connect with how many oxygens connect with how many hydrogens to create water, for example, this is the type of thinking to figure out. If we would draw a similar diagram for oxygen, what we would find is that 2 of these houses would be lacking a partner. And hydrogen, you have only 1 electron, so you would end up with only 1 partner in this house, and none of these others would exist. So 2 hydrogens basically would join in order to fill the shells for the oxygen. So what happens is the way chemistry sort of works is in such a way to try to create as many happy couples here as you can get in the chalets, more or less. The energy levels all work out so that the matching so that you match these pairs of electrons. So chemistry more or less follows from the ideas in quantum mechanics, what energy levels are available along with this idea of spin, and then how the electrons get oriented. So where do I have this? So in chemistry, the whole idea is any chemical reaction is really a rearrangement of what's going on with the electrons in the outer shells. And in some cases, you can get atoms to actually create a configuration where they bind together. And so they can form molecules that way. So the way this works, let me give you an idea. Suppose I have an atom that has Z protons and Z electrons. So whatever kind it is, it's neutral because it has the same number of protons as it does electrons. And let's suppose I have a different atom that has Z prime protons and Z prime electrons, so just something a bit different. And if the shell levels are set up so that it's easy for this atom to sort of pull an electron off that atom, suppose it does. Suppose that an electron gets transferred. Then you can create a situation, if that electron moves over, then we have Z protons and Z minus 1 electrons, which means you have a net negative a net positive charge. So it's a net positive, and then you have Z prime protons and Z prime plus 1 electrons, so we have a net negative charge over here, and they're going to attract each other. And when they do, they basically are held together, and this is something that we call an ionic bond in chemistry. And so sodium chloride, which is normal table salt, basically works in this way, that the chlorine will suck an electron off the sodium, leaving the sodium to be positive while the chlorine is then negative, and then they just attract each other with the Coulomb force and they're held together. And so if you take a bunch of those, they're all held together in sort of this cubic matrix, and that's the structure of table salt. So you can actually understand how table salt's held together. So that's one type of chemical bond. There's a different type where the electrons maybe aren't so easily ripped off, where we have, say, a positive nucleus, and let's say that we have the electron is sort of distributed in its orbital out here, and let's say we have something that's very similar to that nearby. What would happen if these two atoms join each other? One of the things that can happen is that they can sort of overlap like this, where they more or less share an electron here. And what you can imagine is you now have a positive and a positive, and the two positives are pushing away from one another. And then you put negative charge here in the middle, and that will sort of draw the positives together. If the positives get really, really close, there's not so much negative charge between them, and then they'll push each other apart. If they get far away, there's more negative between them, and they'll sort of be drawn together. So you can get this situation where you have an equilibrium situation, and that's known as an ionic bond. And whether you form a covalent bond or an ionic bond or no bond really depends on how the electrons are arranged and how easy they are to exchange or how to be transferred between different atoms. Yeah.
You said the past life was an ionic bond. Is this the covalent bond?
I'm sorry. This is a covalent bond. Thank you. So this is not the ionic bond. This is covalent. I just misspoke. I did say the last one was ionic. Yeah, okay, good. All right, so this class isn't a chemistry class. Thank God. I can say that. I was a chemistry major. I did my time. You've probably seen this or sweated through. Have you seen this periodic chart of the elements before? I'm not going to drag you guys through it so much, but I did want to show it to you. If you go and you play in the laboratory with lots of different types of chemical elements, and you begin to categorize them by their chemical characteristics. What I mean by that is, you know, do they explode if you throw a chunk of them in the toilet? And some things do. If you take a chunk of sodium and you throw it in a toilet, it's going to explode the toilet. Okay. So, but if you take ice water, or if you take a chunk of carbon or something and you throw it in, it doesn't do anything. So those are very different chemical reactivities. So if you go in the lab and you do lots of experiments to categorize things with different chemical reactivities, you can actually begin to group them together in terms of their chemical characteristics. And people did that, and they more or less created what's known as the periodic table, which gives you a reference for how the different elements are chemically reactive. When people understood the quantum mechanics leading to the different orbitals and how to put electrons in those different orbitals, it actually motivated the structure for the periodic chart. So just to let this make a little sense for you, the number up here is the number of protons in the nucleus. That's the positive charge in the nucleus. It's also the number of electrons in the neutral atom. So hydrogen is one proton, one electron. Helium is two protons, two electrons. Lithium is 3 and 3, 4 and 4. Carbon has 6 protons, 6 electrons, on up. And so you get some pretty heavy elements, and you see the highest number we have up here is something like 118. And the reason this is sort of a useful thing for chemists is these are all extremely reactive elements. So hydrogen, if I have pure hydrogen and I put it in an environment where there's some oxygen and I light a match, you get a nice explosion. Okay, it's very reactive. If you take sodium and as I say, pitch it in a toilet, it will explode. So these are all very reactive. The reason they're very reactive is they tend to have, when you do the shell structure in the quantum mechanics, they have an electron that is in a high shell that's unpaired, and it's fairly easy to pull it off. So it makes the chemical element very reactive. Over here, these are extremely inert gases. You could breathe these. They might not keep you alive. You might asphyxiate, but you can breathe in helium. Surely you've done that, right? Yes, I should have brought a balloon. You can breathe in helium, and you can be fine. You sound like an idiot, but you can be completely fine. So why do you sound like an idiot when you breathe in helium? Yeah, you do.
The speed of the wave from your vocal cords changes because it's less dense.
Yeah, it's a less dense gas, so the vibration happens at a different speed. So all of a sudden, what you're used to hearing changes. So, but the truth is, you could breathe in any of these and be okay. I don't recommend you do it with radon because there is a form of radon that's radioactive, and it would not be good for you. But you could breathe in neon and argon and krypton, and you'd be okay because these are ones where all the chalets are nicely filled, and basically the energy of that atom is pretty happy, and you would have to work pretty hard to take an electron off of any of those atoms. So they're chemically not reactive. And then you have lots of things in between. The reason that you have H2O for water is that the oxygen here lacks 2 electrons from being full. And so it bonds with 2 hydrogens to basically fill those two missing electrons. So this is the kind of thinking that you can do to sort of understand chemistry. And a quantum physicist would say, well, you know, we've solved chemistry because we sort of have the idea of what makes it go. It's a little bit of an arrogant way to look at it, but there are quotes from people. Yeah.
So with the ionic bond, is that it's always giving up the electron because of something like the oxygen is too heavy, like it's always giving up the whole delta?
Yeah, the difference between ionic and covalent. In ionic, I just take it from you, okay, and basically we're bound together by the Coulomb force. In covalent, we basically are both holding on to it together and keeping it between us, and that sort of holds us together. I want it more, and I'm stronger. My Coulomb force is more, and I'll just take the thing, right? So if I want your water bottle, I'll just take it. But, you know, if we have about the same strength and you're holding on to it, then I'll grab it, and I'll try to take it, but I can't. So now we're bound together so long as we're holding on to that water bottle. But if I take the water bottle and you know, there's the Coulomb attraction, is you want that water bottle, so you keep following me, sort of. We're bound together, but in a sort of a different way. Yeah?
Can elements ever form ionic bonds with themselves?
Always covalent, because they basically have the same strength. Yeah, so. And they do. So, for example, hydrogen isn't typically found as a single proton and electron. It's typically found as two protons with two electrons in a little molecule. Yeah. Okay, so fortunately, nature is this way, because if it wasn't, there would only be 100 substances. And life would be actually pretty boring. Because, I mean, we live in an extremely rich world. And the reason it's so rich is we have these 100-ish different substances, but now they can combine in different ways. And when they combine, it changes their electronic structure, which means it changes the color of the light on them. It changes the way in which they can interact. And the molecules can get really quite complicated. So life is really extremely rich because of the way these things can all come together. But in the end, all of chemistry and everything that comes from it is fundamentally quantum mechanics plus electromagnetism. With the only caveat being something has to hold the nucleus together, but we haven't started talking about that yet. So in a sense, quantum mechanics really gives you this whole picture. And the fundamental force that holds it all together is just electromagnetism. So my hand does not go through that because of the electromagnetic force that these molecules in the wood are holding together. Even though it's almost all empty space, there's a force there that's holding them together. And when I hit it with my molecules, I mean, except under certain circumstances, if I have something really sharp and I hit it really hard, I can't separate them. So it sort of matters like a force field in some sense. Any thoughts, questions? All right. You just had chemistry 132 in 10 minutes or less. All right. So I rushed through that a little bit because although it's really cool and rich and important, it's not really the focus of this class. And sort of as a physicist, by virtue of being a physicist, you sort of think of it as a little bit boring. It's sort of like, yeah, okay. Now I want to talk about the really weird stuff about quantum mechanics, or at least get it started. We're going to carry it into Wednesday. Let us suppose that we have a very narrow opening in some chunk of metal or something. And let me suppose that we have an electron or a beam of electrons that are headed toward that opening. If electrons are particles, they'll go straight through this opening and you'll have a sharp shadow on the screen in the back, if you want to think about it. So let's imagine that we have a screen back here which has detectors on it that can tell us where the electron hits and give us an image of where the electron beam is hitting. The problem is we've discovered that electrons are waves. Yes?
This may not really be important, but how do you get a beam of electrons?
Well, you could imagine having a metal where the electrons are held very loosely. And then put a powerful battery across it so that you have the metal be negative and a positive screen here, for example. And actually, a way to do that would be to take a thin filament and heat it up. And when you do that, you're giving energy to the electrons that are sort of in the metal. And so they're almost ready to just pop out of the metal. So if you have a thin filament and then you put a battery across it where you have a positive screen over here, these electrons will actually be pulled out by the Coulomb force. And they'll be accelerated toward the screen. And if you have a little hole, you can actually just have them zip right out. So there are ways to get it started. And then once you've got them, you can sort of put them through more batteries if you want. So let us suppose we have this beam of electrons. But now we have to remember that electrons are waves. And so what happens if we think of the electron as a wave? Well, we know all about waves. We've seen what happens to waves when they go through narrow little openings. Waves will diffract. So the electron, as a wave, should do something like this. So if we were to send a million electrons through this hole and ask, where do they show up on the detector on the far part? You don't get a sharp shadow. You get a bright center and then a diffuse spreading outside. You've actually seen it with light. So in this case, if I just put an X for, you know, a handful of electrons and where they might interact, you might get, you know, the most probable one might be here, but you might also get the X's are sort of, this X would actually be hitting this part. It's just as I get more of them, I'm sort of drawing them in this way. So in fact, you'll get a probability distribution for how these electrons hit this thing that would look something like this. It would peak directly beneath this hole, but the probability of the electron hitting, if I think of this as probability, the probability diminishes as you go off away from this peak, but it's not zero. And this is because of the wave nature of the electron. You okay with that? So we can't really think of the electron as a point-like thing where we know where it is at any given time. We actually think of it as that it has a wave function. And we call that mathematical function, if this direction is x, psi of x. Okay? So psi of x is sort of a measure of of what the wave looks like as a function of position. It turns out that in solving Schrodinger's equation for the wave function for psi of x, you'll get in the solution the square root of minus 1, and that may dredge up bad memories. That's called an imaginary number. And it turns out that it's really, you can't really physically interpret imaginary numbers. So it turns out that when you solve for psi itself, it's not physically interpretable. But what is physically interpretable is psi squared, which gets rid of this strange square root of minus 1. So it turns out that psi of x is not really well defined. But psi square is well defined, and it corresponds to the probability of finding the electron at a given point. So this probability distribution of where the electron is when it hits the detector is basically a picture of the square of the wave function of the electron as it goes through. You okay with that? This comes from this interpretation of the wave function. I mean, you got to understand, this stuff is being invented, right? Oh, the electron's a wave. Cool. Now we have to, you know, work up the physical mechanics for how we deal with waves that have mass. And then when you do that, you find out you get these imaginary functions. What the hell are these functions? And so, I mean, they're making this stuff up. So the guy who did this interpretation of the wave function is Max Born. His granddaughter is Olivia Newton-John, if you know her. Max Born and Emil Wolff, who is an old physicist, and you'll see him going around. I mean, he's a cute little guy, and he's always around in the physics department. He's actually a very famous physicist. He's a very famous quantum optics person, one of the most famous ones out there. And he wrote a textbook with Max Born called Born and Wolff. It's a very classic optics textbook. And Max Born's granddaughter signed a publicity photograph and gave it to Emil. So if you go in the physics department in the lobby, you go past the main door and you turn and you look to your right, you'll see autographed copies of Olivia Newton-John publicity photographs for Emil Wolff. I'm sorry. You just don't normally see, you know, pictures of pop stars on the walls of physics departments. It was sort of funny. At any rate, so Max Born was very influential, won the 1954 Nobel Prize for this basic interpretation of the wave function. So So there we go. Nothing weird so far. Let us let the weirdness begin before it does.
Why square instead of bringing it to the fourth, or like multiplying by a negative? It seems arbitrary. Is there any reason behind the square, or is it just because it was the simple? It seemed like the simplest.
I would say it's the simplest way to get rid of the imaginary part, which is not physically interpretable. It's the simplest thing to do, to create a real number, which is something you can physically interpret.
It still changes the, you know, it changes the quantity.
Yeah, it does. And so I don't know if you get into, you're right. If the psi square wasn't interpretable, you might look at some other mathematical way to try to figure out what it is.
Like, why don't they square the number under the radical and then take the square root of that, so they get the, you know, like the positive, like the absolute value of the number of the psi.
Yeah, you could play that kind of game too. you could try to define it that way. I mean, I you would end up with the same thing. The amplitude would just be down. I think that I'd have to think about whether the probability would be confirmed. I mean, I don't know. Those are good questions. But this is what they did. Let me now begin to give you just a sense of where we're headed and how things are going to get with quantum mechanics. We've got our electron going, and we have our detectors that can tell us where the electron will hit. And we have, if I send 1,000 electrons, what the square of the wave function tells me is I know how they will be distributed. So if I were to plot probability, I would get something that would look like this. And so that more or less tells me the distribution of 1,000 of these electrons. But let us consider just one electron, okay? What do we know about one electron? What I know is that this electron goes through this hole. When I solve for the quantum mechanics of it, I cannot know where that electron is going to actually interact with this detector. All I know, all I get from quantum mechanics is this square of the wave function, which gives me this probability distribution. So that means up until the very instant that the electron interacts, the square of the wave function has to look like this. And I'm going to get loose with the square of the wave function. I'm going to probably stop saying the square of. I'm going to say the wave function, but what I mean is the square. So the wave function has this form, and it has to have that form up until the very instant that the electron interacts. Because otherwise, there would be a non-zero, you know, I wouldn't have the probability distribution just right. So that probability is totally preserved up until that last second. Then the electron interacts somewhere. And I cannot, from my calculations in quantum mechanics, I cannot know where. All I know is this distribution. The electron now interacts somewhere. Let's say the electron happens to interact right here. At that instant, that very instant of time, I now know exactly where the electron is. And the probability distribution changes. So the wave function at that instant becomes a spike with probability 1 right here. Okay? And you say, okay, so what? Well, you go from this to that instantaneously. How does this part of the electron wave function know it ain't supposed to be there anymore? Right? It could be far away. So this is really bothersome. We call this collapse of the wave function. And if you look at it, it seems to violate causality because you have something that clearly has extent that in an instant clearly doesn't. So how does this process happen? And most of the really strange aspects of quantum mechanics, or many of them, not all, come from this particular problem. Okay, and so there are different ways to interpret it. And I guess that's where we'll start Wednesday. But so quantum mechanics is truly strange, and we're just now getting to the very meat of why it's so weird and how it leads to multiple universes. So.